solved all my problems, Zarandiato. They take these big fillets of red snapper. They would brush on achiote and some chilies, tomato paste, soy sauce, or Worcestershire, and they would put them in baskets. And what they did was interesting. They had these big wood grills.
Good morning. It is just before 5 o'clock. You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, Milk Street Radio, 6 o'clock on the media, and 7 o'clock, weekend edition news from National Public Radio. Partly sunny today, high 62 to 67, breezy northwest winds. Our lows tonight in the upper 40s, and tomorrow a mix of clouds and sun, highs 59 to 64, winds from the northwest gusting up to 25 miles per hour. Grand Rapids Riverfest is Saturday, September 6th. We are excited to welcome Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Find tickets and more information at grandrapidsriverfest.com. It's time now for Milk Street Radio.
I'm Christopher Kimball from Milk Street Radio. If you get off the plane in Athens, you're likely to find souvlaki, moussaka, spanakopita, but what's for breakfast?
Well, if you ask the average Greek, he will tell you Greek breakfast is probably coffee and a cigarette.
An insider's guide to eating just like a Greek. That's coming up this week on Milk Street Radio from PRX. I'm Christopher Kimball, and this is Milk Street Radio. Today, we settle a great debate. Are bone-in steaks a scam?
You know, a lot of times when you hear chefs on TV talking about cooking a piece of meat, they're always saying, hey, bone-in, it adds a lot more flavor. So I really want to know the truth about that.
Meathead Goldwyn is back to set the record straight.
The bone is coated with calcium, and calcium has no flavor. But it is going to alter the cooking dynamics. It's like a heat shield. It's like on the space shuttle.
But maybe there's one exception.
I gotta say, I do like chewing on the bones.
Meathead's Masterclass. That's coming up next on Milk Street Radio from PRX after the news.
Join us Saturday, September 6th for Grand Rapids Riverfest. I'm Jennifer Barr, and I am so excited for this year's lineup. Music starts at 3 o'clock with Alan Sparhawk, a prolific and versatile musician best known as the frontman of Low. His many side projects over the years reveal a musician unafraid to experiment. Then we'll hear Jeremy Albino. His songs are grounded in the gritty storytelling of classic country music propelled by the rhythms of old school R&B. And then Margot Price. She has something to say but nothing to prove, and in just a few solo albums she has cemented herself as a force in Americana music. We'll end our night with Courtney Barnett, one of Australia's most successful musical exports. She has played many festivals around the world, including Coachella, Bonnaroo, Lollapalooza, and now Grand Rapids Riverfest. Find tickets and more info at grandrapidsriverfest.com. See you September 6th.
This is Milk Street Radio from PRX. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Noor Mourad grew up in Bahrain, an archipelago in the Persian Gulf, known as
the Land of a Million Palm Trees.
Those palm trees grow dates that Noor likes to dunk in tahini. She also loves stewed lamb and fenugreek seeds, and above all else, black limes.
I've wanted more than anything to just kind of spread the black lime love around the world.
We'll explore the flavors of Gulf cooking with Noor, but first we're heading to Athens for an insider's food tour of Greece. Carolina Doriti is a Greek chef and tour guide, and she joins me now. Carolina, welcome to Milk Street.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So the first question I have is, I take the red eye from Boston, I get into Athens at 6 or 7 in the morning. What about breakfast?
Well, if you ask the average Greek, he will tell you Greek breakfast is probably coffee and a cigarette.
Right. <that's
what> but I think pies are very popular for breakfast here. And there are many, many different types of pies in Greece, like a warm, sweet bougata pie, for instance, which is filled with a milk custard and topped with powdered sugar and cinnamon. And then we've got Greek yogurt, of course, which is typically served with honey and walnuts.
Okay, I'm going to walk around Athens now. And one of the first questions I always have is, what about the street food? So what are the options in Athens, and what do you recommend?
Of course, there's souvlaki, which is the famous Greek street food. Or then they've got gyros, which is like layered slices of pork, actually, in Greece, and not lamb. Seasoned very nicely, and then slow cooked on a vertical rotisserie until it's almost caramelized on the outside, and then it's nicely and thinly shaved when it's ready.
Authentically in Athens, if you have it wrapped in pita bread, what would they put with it as well? Anything?
Well, the old school souvlaki places, which are my favorite, they will put some sliced tomato and some chopped parsley, onions, red onions, which in Greece are very sweet and crispy, and either yogurt or some tzatziki, which is yogurt mixed with garlic and grated cucumber.
So I walk into a restaurant. How do I navigate the menu? Like, what are some of the things I should be aware of? What are some of the things I should watch out for, etc.?
Well, first of all, usually in Greece, most people speak English. So the best way, I think, is to talk to the waiter and get their advice, because there might be things that you would never understand them in the menu to order them.
Okay, give me an example of that.
Like green beans. It might say green beans and you will have, I don't know, you will probably imagine boiled green beans. But this is a stew that is cooked in olive oil and tomato and carrots and potatoes, and it's fantastic when the beans are in season and they're fresh. Or you may read in a menu fava, and it will have nothing to do with fava bean. It will be a yellow creamy paste, which is made of a type of yellow split pea, which is very traditional in Greece.
These are great. Okay, keep going. I like this list.
Yeah, so then you might also read fricassé, which is something you might be familiar with from the French cuisine. But Greek fricassé is completely different. It's a type of meat, usually lamb, goat, pork, chicken, cooked with seasonal greens, often foraged greens, or it can be greens like lettuce and chard. And then you finish it off with an egg and lemon sauce. Fantastic dish. And then we've got some recipes with intestines, such as kokoretsi, for instance. So in Greece, kokoretsi is usually liver and other offal wrapped with intestines and then slow cooked, ideally over charcoal while it rotates. And then this is thinly sliced. But when this is done properly, and most people prefer to use just liver inside the intestines, and they season it very well with oregano, so it's quite aromatic. It's really, really good, I think.
Let's talk about ouzo. So is this a drink, like a pastis or something you might have to develop your appetite before dinner? Is it something you drink after dinner? Or is it something that's strictly had with food?
You can have it before dinner, but most Greeks, the moment they put the first drop of alcohol in their mouth, they want something to eat along. So ouzo is the classic drink we pair seafood in Greece. And there are restaurants called ouzeri, and these restaurants most commonly focus on seafood.
Why ouzo pairing with seafood?
Because it cleanses your palate and it pairs fishy flavors, like strong fishy flavors, like even, you know, like mackerel and, you know, anchovies and sardines. It pairs really well with them.
So what about the higher end restaurants in Greece? What are their takes on traditional recipes?
There are many ways to see how you can modernize a recipe or take a different turn. I mean, some may want to deconstruct it. In my opinion, Greek cuisine is very fashionable in its traditional, old-school form because it's a very sustainable cuisine and it's a very seasonal cuisine. And I think that naturally it really represents the, you know, the big trends of cooking at the moment.
So I get off the plane and you meet me and you say to me, look, whatever else you get out of this trip, here are the three things you should never do when you're in Athens.
Well, eat near the Acropolis or drink. Yeah, do not eat near the Acropolis. Do not ask your hotel where to eat. And do not ask a taxi driver where to eat.
Now, the taxi driver is going to send you to his brother's place or something?
To his cousin.
His cousin, yeah, of course. Carolina, thank you so much. Now I have my list. I need to go to Athens.
I hope you call me when you're here.
I definitely am calling you.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Carolina Doriti. She's a chef, also bureau chief for Culinary Backstreets Athens. Her upcoming cookbook is The Greek Islands Cookbook. Now it's time to answer your barbecue and grilling questions with our special guest co-host, Meathead Goldwyn. Meathead is the founder of AmazingRibs.com, also author of Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling. Hey, Meathead, what's going on?
Hello, Christopher. It's good to be back with you.
We talked about marinating many times, and you know that I have made a career about saying marinating doesn't work. But we did find, I don't know if you comment on this, that with chicken, sometimes pork, a yogurt marinade seemed to actually work. It can't be a super thick piece of meat. But there's something in a dairy product, a yogurt, that seemed to actually penetrate into the, let's say, a chicken skewer, for example.
Yes.
I noticed that other marinades just don't get inside, but why yogurt?
I think it's primarily the acidity. Acid does work on protein, and it can soften it. In fact, if you marinate something in an acid too long, it will make the skin or the surface mushy. Now, of course, marinating in yogurt is an old Indian tradition. I mean, all your tandooris. But I've been playing a lot with pickle brine, which is the same thing. It's a high acid. It does penetrate. Now, I've been with you for years. I've been preaching that marinades are a surface treatment. They don't penetrate. They don't get deep into the meat. They don't alter the center of the flavor. But the acidity is a distinct effect, and it works primarily on the surface. And it can actually, I think, aid the crisping of chicken skin.
I just want to say publicly, this is an exception to the Kimball rule. I got to look and just... Okay, let's take some calls.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
This is Bill from Scottsdale.
So how can we help you today?
My question is kind of three parts, and they're all kind of interrelated. So, you know, a lot of times when you hear chefs on TV talking about cooking a piece of meat, they're always saying, hey, bone in, it adds a lot more flavor. So I really want to know the truth about that, if bone in makes it better and why. And then the second question is a standing rib roast. What's the best way to cook it? And the third question is a tomahawk steak, is it really worth the bucks? Is it really a viable piece of meat? I'd love to hear your opinions on that. Thank you.
These are good questions. First of all, the bone is coated with calcium, and calcium has no flavor. Now, the interior of the bone has lots of flavor. There's fat, and the stuff that makes blood is down in there. So if you're going to make a stew, say with short ribs, and throw them into a stew where there's wine and water and stuff, they will extract flavor from the interior of the bone. But if you're cooking on a grill or in a pan or in your oven, that's dry cooking, and there's nothing going to get the flavor out of the marrow. All you've got is the calcium. Now, the calcium is not going to affect the flavor of the meat directly, but it is going to alter the cooking dynamics. That is to say, it's like a heat shield. It's like on the space shuttle. It's going to block heat from entering the meat. And if you've ever sat down with a bone-in ribeye, you know the meat closer to the bone is a little less cooked. It's more rare than it is on the other side. What's the old song? The closer to the bone, the sweeter the meat. That's it. It's going to alter the heating dynamics of the meat, and so you'll have one side more cooked and one side less cooked. So I take the bone off, and I save the bone, and I use it for making stock. And this way, I get the meat cooked evenly all around. And I do the same thing for a prime rib. Now, you asked about a standing rib roast.
Right.
That slab of ribs is going to block heat from coming in. And I want the meat to cook evenly on all sides. So I cut that slab off, and that slab is a meal. I mean, that's a meal for two. It's marvelous, and I'll grill or smoke that. And then I'll cook the rib roast just the meat, and I'll take a lot of the fat off of there too, and it's just fantastic. And that's called the eye of the ribeye. So I get the bones out of the way. I think they alter the heating physics of the whole thing. And then your question on tomahawk steaks. Tomahawk steak is just a bone-in ribeye, but they've left the whole rib. Usually it's just a portion of the rib from the back, but they've left the side of the, and you're paying for that bone. It is cool. Let's face it. It is just very cool. It's impressive, but I don't think it has any impact on flavor.
Unless you marinate it for 30 days in bourbon.
Now, I got to say.
And then it's really good.
I got to say, I do like chewing on the bones. So if I do cook it with bone in, I do get pleasure from chewing on the bone.
That's great. So, you know, based on what you're telling me, too, talking about the heat shield, especially with the tomahawk, that's why I think I've always been disappointed with those steaks, because I find them not as tender as a regular ribeye, and the cooking on, again, to your point, is very uneven, and I think your explanation really helps me understand the whole thing. So that was excellent. Thank you.
Bill, thanks so much for calling.
Okay, and thanks so much for taking my call, and all the best to both of you.
Good luck.
Take care. This is Mill Street Radio. Before your next barbecue, give us a ring, 855-426-9843. One more time, 855-426-9843. Or email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, my name's Laura.
And how can we help you today?
I was wondering if you guys had any advice on cooking rabbit on the grill.
Well, I'm not a hunter. I have cooked rabbit that people have brought me, but I think I'm going to defer to the infinite wisdom of Christopher Kimball, who is a hunter.
I do hunt rabbit. So the backstrap, the loin, has to be cooked totally differently than the legs, the back legs. So the backstrap, just like you would with venison, is like a tenderloin, right? You cook tenderloin very quickly over high heat, and that's a few minutes, right? It's done. The legs, however, need to be low and slow. So you essentially barbecue them, right? Or just put them in a low oven or braise them over low temperature, because they're going to take time to break down, and they're much tougher because they obviously, the muscles are well developed. So you just have to separate those two things.
Christopher, do you brine or do you use a special rub or any kind of preparation in advance?
I find that what I like to do with the legs is a little bit of liquid in the pot, you know, a cup and a half, a braise, put it in a low oven and let it cook in like a 275 oven or something like that. I find that to be the best. But you can't cook it fast. You can't grill it. It's just not going to be good.
Can they be confit?
Yes, absolutely. And that's why you do duck confit. Yeah, cook it in oil, you know, for 2 or 3 hours submerged. That's fabulous. Absolutely delicious. Matter of fact, that's probably the best way to cook a rabbit leg. Yeah, confit. Yeah, that's a good idea.
So you wouldn't spatchcock it and cook it like a chicken then?
Do you want to eat it when you're done? Or is this for display purposes? No. Well, let me ask Laura.
I can verify this is a bad idea.
Yeah. So Laura, how have you cooked rabbit? And what's worked and what hasn't?
I tried to cook it a lot like chicken, and I have failed. It's not great that way. No. So your suggestion of splitting up the rabbit has been what I've started to do when I process them.
Mm-hmm.
And so putting my back straps all together and then the legs all together. I haven't figured out a good way to barbecue it.
No. One thing I do when I get back from hunting is I will obviously field dress it, skin it, cut it into the pieces, and then I will put it in salted water overnight. And that cleans it up, but also essentially is a brine. It's a very weak brine. And I find that does help too. But that's what I always do in a cool spot. If it's in November, in the barn or whatever is fine, or in the refrigerator, just let it sit overnight in salted water.
For 1 gallon of water, how much salt would you have in that when you make that weak brine?
The usual formula for brine is 1 cup of regular table salt per gallon. Is that right, Meathead?
Roughly, you want somewhere in the 3 to 6% range, which is, you got to do the math.
So I would do half of that probably for this because it's going to sit there overnight. And it just is, it cleans up the meat, and then you also get some benefit because it's going to hold on to water longer when you cook it.
Okay. I actually have one more question if you guys are willing to take it.
Sure.
I cook every day, but sometimes I forget to take my meat out of the freezer. And so I'm wondering about grilling from frozen.
We just did this at Milk Street. You can take a frozen steak. I do reverse sear method. I put it in a 250 or a 300 oven for maybe 15 or 20 minutes, get the internal temperature up to like 90, 95, and then finish it on the grill or in a skillet. And it turns out it cooked in the same amount of time as a refrigerated steak. So I don't understand why that's true. But this is an inch and a half thick steak. It worked just fine. So you can cook a frozen steak as long as you do the reverse sear.
And so I just use the same principles that I use when I forget and I want to cook it inside.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the concept of reverse sear?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Basically, you warm it at a low temperature.
Right.
And that cooks the interior evenly from edge to edge. And then you sear it afterwards. Right. And up till now, or up till recently, almost all your cookbooks told you to sear it first and then pop it in the oven. And nowadays, conventional wisdom, and I've been teaching this for years, is to reverse sear. And the results are you get a much more even interior temperature and gorgeous exterior crust. So great way to go.
There we
are. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for calling. Take care.
Really appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
This is Mill Street Radio. If you're having a grill emergency, give us a ring anytime, 855-426-9843. That's 855-426-9843. Or send us an email at questions@milkstreetradio.com. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, Chris. This is Jorge.
Hey, how are you? Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Los Angeles, California.
Good place. How can we help you?
One of my favorite dishes at restaurants is wood-fired fish. But every time I've tried to recreate the dish on my grill, it's really been a disaster. My fish fillet or whole fish inevitably becomes a mess. And I really need help. I love this dish.
Well, I can help you. I was in Mexico in Nayarit a year or two ago, and we went fishing in the morning, and then in the evening we went to Bar Fernando. And they did a fish preparation which solved all my problems, zarandeado. They take these big fillets of red snapper. They would brush on achiote and some chilies, tomato paste, soy sauce, or Worcestershire, and they would put them in baskets. And what they did was interesting. They had these big wood grills, but they'd angle the baskets at about a 45-degree angle. So the fish was cooked very low heat. And the fish was on there for like 20 minutes, half an hour, a long time. And you end up with a super meaty flesh that wasn't dry. And so we came back to Milk Street and figured out how to do that. And then you can brush it at the end with more butter, Worcestershire sauce, whatever. But you end up with a very meaty fish that is not dry and flaky. So I think the secret in that case was very low heat, even at an angle off the grill. And that's what we do at home now, is a very low heat. At least that's one way to do it. But Meathead, you probably have 26 better ideas.
Well, you mentioned the baskets. That is absolutely the best solution. If you can imagine, they look like two tennis rackets hinged at the top. And you put the fish on where the strings are. And so you're flipping the basket rather than the fish. The fish may stick to the basket a little, but you're not going to have it self-destruct all over the grill grates. But if you are cooking on the grill grates, the first thing you need to do is get those grates as clean as you can, because metal likes to stick to protein. And I would recommend you leave skin on and you choose a firm fish. Now, the ones that come to my mind first are swordfish or halibut or tuna. You got a few others that you'd recommend, Christopher?
Yeah, any firm whitefish is fine, but I would cook those over very low heat. I mean, you could use cod or whatever, but halibut, of course, is super expensive, as is tuna, and they're great, but the more delicate fish are a little trickier, right?
Yeah, and the more delicate, I absolutely try these fish baskets. You can buy them online. And by the way, oiling the food is better than oiling the grate. When you oil hot metal, the oil cracks. It changes its chemistry. But if you oil the food's 38 degrees out of the fridge. It stays cool a little longer. Oil the fish, and eventually it will let go of the metal. So don't force it. And I did something interesting. I got one of my spatulas, and I took it down to my basement where I've got a grinder. And I ground the edge really sharp, like razor sharp, so it can get deep under something. But you wouldn't want to really go scraping it off the surface if you can avoid it. And another fun tip is, while it's cooking, if you want, got some old herbs it's time to replace, throw them on the fire, some sawdust, some wood chips. They put out a little smoke, not a lot. The fish is going to cook quickly, and that really amps it up a notch.
I was nodding my head until you got to the herbs. In southern France, when they cook over vines, right? I mean, you have a massive amount of that. But a few herbs is really going to make a difference on coals?
It gives it smoke. It's not going to give you an herb flavor per se. In fact, it smells like marijuana. Your neighbors are going to come over and ask you what the hell you're smoking. I'll also take a big bowl or pan and lay it on top of the fish so that puff of smoke that comes from the dried herbs or the sawdust will get trapped in the gap above the fish, and that will also help the process a little. You want to take the fish to 125 to 135 at the most. You absolutely can't overcook fish.
I do about 120, but what I've found is, especially tuna, it just keeps cooking. You can take it off, it's rare, and by the time you eat it, it's like well done.
If you overcook tuna, you might as well eat it out of the can. It's just no good.
I think we mostly agree. Does that answer your question at all?
Yeah, those are amazing tips. Something to try, absolutely.
And look up Zarandeado, Zarandeado, because that, for me, is like my go-to recipe now, especially for a thin filet. You know, thicker filets you can just grill, but the thinner filets are just murder. So try that in a basket in very low heat. All right, thank you very much. Hope that's helpful.
Absolutely helpful. Great. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Special thanks to Meathead for joining me on the phone line. Up next, black limes and Bahraini street food with Noor Murad. Hey, Milk Street listeners. As fall approaches, I've asked Stella Parks to help me answer your baking questions. From spice cakes to Halloween candies and beyond, we're opening the phone lines to tackle your autumn baking projects. Please email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com. Again, please send your fall baking questions to questions@milkstreetradio.com, and we'll be in touch. And thanks.
I'm Chelsea Perkins with the KAXE Newsroom. We're still reporting, but our future just became uncertain. Congress voted to strip critical funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. That means $228,000 cut from KAXE and a major hit to rural journalism. These aren't just numbers. They're the resources we use to bring you the facts, to hold power accountable, and to tell your stories. Help keep the news alive in northern Minnesota. Go to KAXE.org or text DONATE to 218-326-1234. KAXE is powered by the people, including you.
I'm not crying, but I wish I could. Heart snapped off like plywood.
This is Mill Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Right now, it's my conversation with Noor Mourad. She was a recipe developer at the Ottolenghi Test Kitchen, and now she's out with a new cookbook called Lugma. The recipes are inspired by her home country, Bahrain, and the rest of the Persian Gulf. Noor, welcome to Mill Street.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So, how do you define Gulf food versus Middle Eastern food? What's the difference?
Well, Gulf food is quite unique, I think, and I think not enough is really known about it. But it's a real mixture of different foods. I'll take Bahrain as an example, which is where I grew up. But Bahrain, being a small island, really pulls on different influences and different cultures. So the three big flavors are like Arabic flavors, Indian flavors, and Persian flavors kind of combined into one. And that's all due to like it being an important seaport throughout history and a center of trade. Seafood is really huge in Bahrain. But Gulf food is known for its like grand rice dishes, like big platters, slow-cooked meats, lots of very heavy on bold flavors, loads of spices. But every region and every country is different to the other, which is why I say it's really hard to paint the whole of the Middle East with one brush when every single area has something different to offer.
So tell me about Bahrain. So it's an archipelago of more than 30 islands. Mm-hmm. You say it's equal parts arid desert, high-rise city, salty sea, hot tarmac, stifling heat and calm waters. So for those of us who've never been there, maybe you could just describe it for a minute?
Yeah, Bahrain is a really interesting place. I feel like it's definitely changed a lot and modernized over the years. So that's why all the skyscrapers and modern roads come in. But Bahrain also has kind of held on to its old ways in a way. It's got like all the souks and the little alleyways and the little markets that still kind of hold a huge place and are like the heart of Bahrain. And yeah, it is kind of like it's kind of stuck between old and modern in some ways.
So your dad went out fishing on Fridays to a disappearing island, which sounds something out of a great adventure book from the 19th century. So what is a disappearing island? And did he go out just to be alone? Did he go out because he loved fishing? This is his way to have some peace and quiet. Why did he go out every Friday?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone in my family in Bahrain, they have an affinity with the sea. But my dad is a fisherman, much more as a hobby. You know, he'd go out in the weekends, probably to get away. It was like his thing to go with his friends and have a beer and go do some fishing, you know. But the disappearing island is actually just a very whimsical way of talking about a sandbank that exists in the middle of the sea. So during high tide, it's not visible. And during low tide, it's just this stretch of sand surrounded by water. And it's just so magical. So we would time it on the weekends so that we'd arrive there during low tide. And we'd anchor the boat. And it would be my sister and I, my mom and my dad. And yeah, we'd spend the whole of as many hours as we could before high tide came again. And it would be very just like something really magical. Like, so I wanted to kind of bring it to life in the book. So I wrote the story of the disappearing island and mom's sandwiches and then the recipe that was inspired by that.
So the title of the book, Lugma, means a bite. It probably means more than that. So to you, what does that mean?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it definitely had like two meanings brought to life with this book. The first one was just because of my career working in food and then working as a recipe developer. Ottolenghi was very much like my whole career at the time was about taking bites of food and analyzing it to make the perfect recipe or dish, which made sense for the book. But it also made sense because of in Bahrain, it's still a culture that we eat with our hands, especially like the rice dishes. There's a real skill to eating with your hands. My grandfather was a master of it. And we're real feeders as well. We love to feed people and often offer of our own plates. So I always say that like when someone goes to make you a bite off of their plate and hand it to you from their hand, it's a gesture of love. So for me, lugma is the ultimate form of love. If someone tries to feed you in that way, then they must really care about you. It's quite an intimate thing to do, I think.
I loved your description of black lime so much. I went out and bought some. because I've had them, but I never had them in my kitchen. You want to describe, there's two things I want you to describe, black limes and fenugreek, which is one of the strangest, wildest tasting spices ever. So could you just describe what they're like and how you like to use them?
Yeah, so black limes are the backbone of cooking in Bahrain, and I'd say the Gulf, Iran, and Iraq. But they're basically dried limes. So you can find them in the lighter, kind of like, they look kind of like grayish, greenish, or the black limes. And they're sun-dried limes. The only difference between the lighter ones and the black ones is the black ones have been heat-treated to get that really dramatic color. But basically, we use them in everything in Bahrain. Like, you poke a few holes in them, they're rock hard, they're hollow. But as soon as you add them to a liquid, they kind of soften and slowly release their flavor. They've got like this kind of earthy, bitter flavor that you can't really substitute with fresh limes. Fresh limes are zingy and like really refreshing, whereas these ones are just have this deep, deep, deep flavor. You can also, we add them to rice dishes as well, grind them up, use them as a marinade for all kinds of meats. Use them in desserts, use them as a base for a tea, which I've been making a lot lately, and it's been a real hit. They're just so, so versatile. And I've wanted more than anything to just kind of spread the black lime love around the world. And then fenugreek, the fresh fenugreek halbe is a bit harder to find, so I don't really include it much in the book. And then it comes also as a leaf that can be dried, and people call that methi. And that's used a lot, obviously, in Indian cooking. But what I like to use a lot, which people can be a bit afraid of, is the fenugreek seeds. So the fenugreek seeds are so hard, they're kind of like little stones. They're even quite hard to grind. You need a lot of like arm power to grind it into a pestle and mortar. So the best thing is to use a spice grinder to blitz it up. They're also quite bitter. But when you pair them with different spices and a little bit of sugar, it just makes this wonderfully complex spice base that I use a lot in stews. There's a slow-cooked lamb with fenugreek, and it's just so fragrant and so wonderful and such an underrated spice, I think, that people should definitely use it a bit more.
So dates with tahini, chili, and salt. Could you describe what this is? Is this, you say it's a typical snack.
Yeah, so we call it tamar with harda, which is basically dates with tahini. So dates are grown everywhere in Bahrain. There's a lot of date palms. Way back before, you know, now we're talking about Bahrain in the 1950s. It used to be called the land of a million palm trees because Bahrain was just desert and palm trees, date palms. A lot of like families harvest their own dates, like mine included. Like my dad's retirement project is his date harvest. It's just a huge part of the culture. And there's so many different varieties as well. But the common one is khalas dates, which are kind of, they're very, very sticky and sweet. Whereas I feel like majdul dates, which are more popularized in the West, they're like the Palestinian dates. They're a lot bigger and meatier, whereas khalas dates are smaller and stickier. And you dip them into some tahini, so you get a little bit savory, something nutty and savory in the sweet date. And you have it with strong Bahraini gahwa, which is Arabic coffee. And Bahraini coffee is infused with saffron and cardamom, and it's the green coffee beans. So it doesn't look like coffee because it kind of looks a bit yellowy-orange, but it's very, very strong. And you have it in like this finial, which is looks like a little shot glass. And because it's so strong, our desserts and our dates are very sweet, so it balances it out.
Cardamom is a typical ingredient in lots of places with coffee, but I've never heard of saffron with coffee.
Yeah, it's different. Not, you know, it's like Marmite. Some people love it, some people hate it, but I love it so much.
Mathruba, beaten chicken and rice. This is not something I've had, so you want to explain that?
Yeah, madruba is very close to my heart. I really, really love this dish. So madruba in Arabic means beaten. And it's basically a dish of, think of like any kind of spiced rice dish, like a biryani or something, you know. It begins with like ginger, garlic, green chili, loads of spices, tomatoes in the base, And then you add the chicken, bone in, you add the rice, and then instead of adding enough water to make it like a pilaf, you add a lot of water, too much water, and you let it simmer for like an hour and a half or so on a really low and gentle heat. So the rice kind of becomes overcooked and the chicken becomes super, super tender. And then you shred the chicken, remove the bones, and you just beat the whole thing. And traditionally, this was done in a sort of cylindrical pot. So the women would sit on the floor and put the pot between their feet to secure it. And then they'd take a long wooden paddle and they would beat the rice and chicken against the sides of the paddle. So that kind of gave it that consistency of like pulled rice and chicken. And the result is like this kind of like a savory porridge meets congee vibe. And it's so, so delicious. You top it with loads of fried onions and like ghee on top and herbs and lemon. It's typically served during Ramadan because after fasting for the whole month, it's super satiating and easy on the stomach. And there's something just really lovely about having those food traditions. And I always, for the longest time, I think it was always about like, okay, I need to come up with a new inventive recipe and a new thing. And definitely when I started writing Logma, I really went back to like, what do I really want to eat? And since then, I feel like my cooking has really changed. It's really simplified and it's really gone back to what I grew up eating.
So, okay, so let's say I go to Bahrain. Give me the short list of what I should eat or what I should experience if I went there for a week.
Okay, so Bahrain has a really great street food scene. If you wanted like the traditional like rice dishes and slow-cooked stews, you'd need to go to a Bahraini house because that's where you're going to find it. But on the other hand, the Bahraini street food scene, you would have to go to the souks, and those are like the local markets. We have the two big ones, which is Manama Souk, which is Bahrain's capital, and then there's Mhareg Souk. So there, in Manama Souk, you would have to go to this place called Alu Bashir. And they only serve one thing. It's chickpeas in this like spicy, tangy, vinegary hot sauce. And they pour it over a fried samosa. It probably costs you like, I don't know, a couple dollars. And it's so, so delicious. And then you'd have to go to Tikka Amin, which is this place. I mean, there's loads of places that have tikka, but people always think of tikka like the Indian tikka masala and tandoori chicken and stuff. But Bahraini tikka is actually just skewered meat that's marinated in ground black lime. So the black lime gives it this really earthy, acidic taste, but it also acts as a tenderizer for the meat. And it's put onto skewers, and in between every few pieces, they put some lamb fat as well. And they cook it on charcoal. And it is so, so delicious. Mm. It's served on a big piece of tandoor bread, which is like bread from the clay oven. It's all like bubbly. And they put this skewers, however many skewers you order, with raw onion, chili and rocket, and sometimes like this little like yogurt sauce.
You're killing me. This sounds so good.
You eat it, you tear off the bread and you eat it and it's hot, it burns your hands. Obviously you have to eat with your hands. We don't do forks here. And you have some of this like melty lamb fat. Mm. And the meat is like so tender and acidic, and like you just get the spice from the raw onion, chili, and you make a lugma. And you just eat it, and it is one of the most amazing street foods that I think exists.
Noor, thank you so much. It's been it's just been really fun, and I learned a lot. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate all your questions.
That was Noor Murad. Her book is Lugma, Abundant Dishes and Stories from My Middle East. Coming up, Adam Gopnik considers the cherry. I'm Christopher Kimball, and this is Milk Street Radio. Now let's head into the kitchen with J.M. Hirsch to talk about this week's recipe, Cantonese barbecued pork. J.M., how are you?
I'm doing great.
Char siu is the topic today. I just made it last night, and it was good and bad. The good was I loved it. I had three helpings. But I tried to tell my kids it was just bacon, you know. Nah. Anyway, it's absolutely delicious. And I was really enamored with the fact it's not hard to do as well. So how do you make it?
Well, next time, tell the kids that it's candied bacon. That'll get them.
Well, I said sweet bacon, but candied bacon.
Okay. Well, the way to think about char siu is this. Combine the flavors of the very best Chinese takeout with the tender, meaty succulence of the perfect Southern barbecue. That is char siu. It is sold all over Hong Kong. It's often a lunch staple at, you know, just stalls. And what really makes it so good is the lacquering glaze that the pork is finished with. It gets this sweet sauce sloshed on at the very end, and that just caramelizes over the heat, and it just gives it this perfect combination of sweet and savory, tender, fatty, and lightly charred. So you're getting this push and pull of all these different flavors and all these different textures. It's really just a fantastic way of cooking pork.
So the basic method, there's a marinade, like soy sauce, etc., then it's grilled for 15 or 20 minutes. And this is pork shoulder, so it's got some fat in it.
Right.
And then it's glazed and finished off. So the whole cooking's, you know, unlike a real barbecue, which could be hours, this is like under half an hour, right?
It's really fast. And the only thing that takes any time is the marination. You know, based on what we tasted in Hong Kong, we season it with brown sugar, soy sauce, Chinese five spice, fresh ginger, and some salt. I mean, there's a lot of flavor packed into that. Let it sit for at least 4 hours, but you can let it go for as much as 24 hours if you want. Then, as you say, you grill it low and slow for about 20 minutes or so, and then the magic happens. That's when you hit it with this glaze at the very end, which is a combination of honey and Shaoxing wine and black pepper, and then give it another few minutes over the heat. And again, that glaze sets up and it becomes this perfectly lacquered finish. It's a wonderful, wonderful way of finishing the meat.
In Hong Kong, do they just eat it with rice? What do they do with it?
So they'll eat it either warm or at room temperature, typically over white rice. But the leftovers, now the leftovers, those are wonderful, because what you do is you cut those up into little bits and you use those to make fried rice, a little bit of egg, some scallion. Oh, it's a wonderful combination because, again, you're getting that sweet and savoriness out of the meat and it's just perfect in a fried rice.
JM, thank you. Char siu or Cantonese barbecued pork. Less than half an hour on the grill. Great on rice, great in stir-fried rice, and great as a sandwich. Thank you.
Thank you. You can get the recipe for Cantonese barbecued pork at milkstreetradio.com.
This is Milk Street Radio. Now it's time to check in with our regular contributor, Adam Gopnik. Adam, how are you?
I am well, Chris. Today, I wanted to share with you my own meditation on a very small subject, and that is the tart cherry.
Okay. If
I had to pick a single fruit from all around the world and the whole range of tastes, I would take the tart cherry. Its virtues and its joys are many, and like all true virtues and joys, I think you'll agree, allied to an undue amount of labor. That is that with tart cherries, you have to pit them, and you can only pit them one by one.
You get the $25 plastic Norco cherry pitter.
Yes, and of course, it creates major red squirt action on my linen shirt or apron, so that when I'm done prepping a tart cherry crisp, I look like Sweeney Todd in Act Two. Do you share my passion for tart cherries?
It is one of my favorite fruits of the summer, yeah. My favorite is actually a tart cherry pie.
Yes. I spend the month of June and July making tart cherry crumble and tart cherry crostata and tart cherry Hungarian soup made with red wine and topped with sour cream. I don't know if you know that dish.
Yes, but I do. Yeah.
It is one of my favorite things. Now, you are asking yourself, Christopher, why does he feel this passionately about the tart cherry?
or words to that effect, Adam.
Yeah, I could sense it. And it's certainly true that my obsession with the tart cherry intertwines with my notorious francophilia. For the tart cherry, though obviously grown here in New York State and obviously a major agricultural industry in Michigan and Washington, is in its origins, did you know this, Chris, a French cherry.
Oh, nice.
French tart cherries are called a Montmorency cherry. Montmorency is a little suburb of Paris, and that's where the tart cherry was born. There was even a cherry festival there for many years. And you use the expression in French, le temps de cerise, the time of the cherries, as the ultimate idiom for a great good time, a time of ultimate pleasure. You say, that year was our temps de cerise, the year after our wedding, or perhaps the year after our divorce. But whenever you're trying to indicate a perfectly happy time, you call it the temps de cerise. Now, here's where my obsession with tart cherries takes a very peculiar and historic turn. And stick with me here, because we have to go on a kind of roller coaster.
Dark. You're going dark now.
I am going dark, exactly. Yeah. The lights come down at this moment. Because it involves the man whom I think of as the greatest popular music performer of 20th century French popular music, and that is the great Charles Trenet. And when I was a young man, I used to listen to his songs and dream of Paris. And one of the most famous of all of those songs is a song called Le Temps de Cerise. J'oublierai jamais le temps de cerise, et souvenir que je garde au cœur. I will never forget the cherry time and the memories that I keep in my heart. Now, after I had moved to Paris a few years ago, I learned something that made me incredibly sad because I was such a fan of Trenet and of his songs. And that is that he'd had a very, what the French call an ambiguous war. During the occupation and collaboration of the 1940s, he'd continued to perform for German officers.
For the Vichy government,
yes. Exactly. And I learned something that caused me even more pain, Chris, which was that those songs that I had loved so much were recorded in the 1940s exactly as kind of ideological anthems for the Vichy government. And then, having felt very sad about that for years, when I was studying the history of the Montmorency cherry to talk to you about it today, I discovered something that blew my mind. And that is that the song Le Temps de Cerise is not actually a Trenet original. It was the clandestine resistance song of the communards. You know who they were? They were the people in 1871 who rebelled, the Parisians who rebelled against the new royalist government in a great popular rebellion. They were brutally crushed. They were not allowed to express themselves. And that song, Le Temps de Cerise, I will never forget, Cherry Season, was their subterranean, clandestine song of resistance. When they talked about the Temps de Cerise, they meant the time of the commune, and they meant their memories that they kept dear. And then I realized that that's what Trenet was doing.
Trenet, this is revisionist history now.
Yes, he was slipping that song past the German and the Vichy censors because they would hear it simply as one more Petainist hymn to the French countryside when it was actually a witty and clandestine gesture designed to wink his way past the guard dog at the gates. So what could be better? My French musical hero is redeemed by his praise of the tart cherry. My heart was so full with this news about the political meaning of the Montmorency cherry that just before I left my kitchen to come to speak to you, I made what I think is the queen of all tart cherry desserts, and that is a cherry clafoutis. And you know what I love most about the cherry clafoutis, Chris?
I'm about to find out.
You can't escape it. It is the one tart cherry recipe where you are compelled to leave the pits inside the cherries.
What a lovely story. The hero becomes the traitor. And finally, at the end of the story, it turns out he was the hero all along.
Oh, exactly.
Adam, that's just what I needed, an heroic ending.
I agree.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Mais il est bien court, le temps des cerises, où l'on s'en va de cueillir en rêvant des pendants d'oreilles.
That was Adam Gopnik, staff writer at The New Yorker. His latest book is The Mystery of Mastery.
Tombant sous la mousse,
That's it for today. To hear all of our episodes, head to milkstreetradio.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We've put together a collection of our all-time favorite recipes from Milk Street. You can find that collection at milkstreetradio.com. You can also find us on Facebook at Christopher Kimball's Milk Street, Instagram at 177 Milk Street. We'll be back next week with more food stories and kitchen questions. And thanks, as always, for listening.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with GBH. Co-founder, Melissa Baldino. Executive producer, Annie Sinzabov. Senior editor, Melissa Allison. Senior producer, Sarah Clapp. Producer, Caroline Davis. Assistant producer, Mari Orozco. Additional editing by Sydney Lewis. Audio mixing by Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Theme music by Tubob Crew. Additional music by George Brendel Egloff. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by PRX.